Blog Talk Radio.
Dorothy, would you start our breaking news, please?
Breaking news number two, Jetstream allows transatlantic record, and this is by Russ Niles. Thanks to a big kick from the Jetstream, Norwegian Airlines is laying claim to the fastest non-Concorde airline flight between New York and London, Gatwick Airport. The Boeing 787-9 hit a top ground speed of 674 knots and made it to the airport just south of London in 5 hours and 13 minutes last Monday, almost an hour faster than usual. Captain Harold Van Dam said, "We were actually in the air for just over 5 hours. If it had not been forecasted for turbulence at a lower altitude, we could have flown even faster."
Breaking news number three. Airbus just landed the $16 billion Emirates deal it needed to survive the iconic A380 Super Jumbo. This is by Benjamin Zhang. Emirates has agreed to a firm order for 20 Airbus A380s, along with an option for 16 additional Super Jumbos. At list prices, Thursday's deal would have cost roughly $16 billion, although it is customary for the aviation industry for import customers such as Emirates to receive major discounts. Earlier this week, Airbus indicated that it would have to consider shuttering the A380 program without an additional order for Emirates. With this order in hand, the iconic double-decker has earned a reprieve from the scrap heap for at least another decade. You can see more of this in the newsletter, January to June 2018. Over to you, Chuck.
clause that took effect this month includes several provisions that impact the various segments of general aviation, from the private owners with small airplanes to corporations with their own fleet of jets. Buyers of business aircraft now can immediately write off the entire cost of their new or pre-owned aircraft. That's good news for general aviation, said AOPA President Mark Barker. We think this inclusion of the immediate spending for used as well as new investment will effectively spur economy growth and create new jobs, especially in the aviation and aircraft industry, Barker said. See more newsletter June 2018. Anybody else hearing?
No, I can't hear anything either.
Jim Hart, you're on the air.
213-816-1611. Say hi or hola or buenos dias. Como esta? Bonjour. To talk with us on the air alive. We can identify many countries in our Blog Talk Radio application. Isn't it great that we can keep the Eastern legacy going out to not only Eastern family, but to listeners from many different countries? That's what we try to do every week on the EAL Radio Show. Won't you join us by adding a voice to these broadcasts? Our thanks also to those who choose to listen by computer using the radio icon on our homepage at www.ealradioshow.com, or perhaps by signing in at the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Should you too wish to talk on our live broadcast, feel free to use our call-in number, 213-816-1611, at 7 p.m. on Monday evening. Let me repeat that number so you can write it down for your Monday night visits. 213-816-1611. That's at 7 o'clock on Monday evening. Our lines are always open for calls, and if you choose not to participate and talk live with our host, we ask you to please mute your telephone, as our producer board does not have the capability of filtering out background noises. Now, Neil, let's get to flight episode number 409 in the air, and hopefully we'll stop the music.
Well, for you guys and gals still flying, you need only three things to set an aviation speed record, which might be called the three P's, and they are pilot, plane, and paper. And you could also add a fourth P for perseverance. You need a lot of that also. First, you need to be a pilot, and that is a licensed pilot. Sorry, no student pilots allowed. Other than that, the sky's the limit. Light sport pilot, recreational pilot, private pilot, commercial pilot, airline transport pilot, military pilot, take your pick. Second, you need to have an airplane. It doesn't need to be a jet or a speed demon, an 18-cylinder terror of the skies. Since the time of Orville Wright, who was involved in creating the original rules, aviation records have been set up so that planes of a similar ilk compete with each other. It might be worth noting here that the first powered flight made by Orville Wright on December 17, 1903, went for a long distance of 120 feet and was 6.8 miles per hour. The bottom line of that legacy is that today, the guy in the Piper Cub doesn't have to compete head-to-head with the gal flying the Learjet. Third, you need to be ready for a plane load of paperwork that needs to be done just right, in just the correct order, and at just the right time. There's also some of that greenback paper involved, but that's true of everything in aviation. Well, that's it, the three P's, and you can become part of aviation history and a member of a very select group of pilots, holders of aviation records. A few Eastern pilots set speed records throughout the history of Eastern Airlines, and here are just a few. Captain John Gill and co-pilot Vern Peterson set a DC-3 record between New York and Miami with an intermediate stop at Charleston. The time was 6 hours and 2 minutes, and that took place in June of 1937. Captain Andy McDonough flew a P-39 to a record 620 miles an hour in a dive during a test flight. Numerous speed records were broken by Eastern Constellations. Burbank to Miami, 6 hours and 54 minutes. Miami to LaGuardia, 3 hours and 25 minutes with Captain Dick Merrill and Mac Johnson with flight engineer Jack Robertson. Houston to New York, 4 hours and 33 minutes with Captain George Freiberger, pilot W.K. Day, and flight engineer R.W. Payne. New York to Miami, 3 hours and 23 minutes with Captain Frank Younger, pilot H.E. Rivenbark, we all know him, and flight engineer Jay Duran. New Orleans to New York was done in 3 hours and 34 minutes with Captain Dick Merrill, Gene Brown, and Slim Thomas, and flight engineer C.E. Clark. Service into Pensacola started on September 29, 1947, and the first plane in was a DC-3 flown by Captain Rosie Rosasco. A speed record for the new route was set with a Connie of 5 hours and 9 minutes. The crew was Captain G. Youngerman, and pilot D.M. Ferguson, and the flight engineer was W. Tharp. Linda?
Yeah, George, there are lots of good reasons to set an aviation record. Number one, you can prove something to yourself. You can impress your grandkids, and anybody at a cocktail party that's crude, rude, and obnoxious, just pull that out. Tell them the fact about your achievement. If you're dating, you can use that information on your dating website, or you can simply leave something that's truly remarkable for people to someday read in your obituary that won't happen for decades from now when you go west, like the pilots say. It's a good way to bring attention to any good cause, because after more than 112 years of pilots setting records, people and the press, they love aviation record-setting stories. Now, before we go into describing some world speed records, some of these may have already been broken because records are meant to be broken. For pilots flying in the United States wanting to set a world record, there are two major players that they have to deal with, and the first is the National Aeronautic Association, or the NAA. The NAA is the official record keeper of Aviation Records in the United States. And these are the folks who give out the Collier Trophy. Ho, ho, that's the Nobel Prize for Aviation. The NAA traces its roots back to 1905 and is a charter member of the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, FAI, the international organization that certifies world records. What kind of a record can be set? Records can be set for altitude, speed, distance, as well as for time to climb, the greatest payload or efficiency. But regardless of the type of record, the process is about the same. A recognized course is simpler than it sounds. You can take any two public use airports that are the right distance apart. For a U.S. record, the two fields must be 125 miles apart. But if you want to shoot for a world record, and why wouldn't you? The two fields must be at least 249 miles apart. George, just recently in the transport category, a very long distance record was set. A Norwegian plane flew from New York to London in 5 hours, 13 minutes. The fastest subsonic commercial transatlantic flight ever, and this just happened this month, January 2018.
That's exactly right, Linda. The low-cost airline has made its headlines for launching the world's longest low-cost flight. It's making headlines again. This was a Norwegian Boeing 787-9 Dreamliner, departed New York's JFK and reached London's Gatwick in 5 hours and 13 minutes. That's unbelievable. And that was on Monday, the fastest subsonic transatlantic flight recorded on a commercial aircraft to date. Now, it beat the previous record, which was at 5 hours and 16 minutes. There were 284 passengers on board who, after leaving New York at 11:44 a.m. Eastern Time, were probably pretty happy to arrive in London at 9:57 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 53 minutes, almost an hour ahead of schedule. You can imagine how happy they were. Strong tailwinds, of course, over the Atlantic Ocean pushed the aircraft to a top speed of 776 miles an hour. That kind of ground speed, I can imagine that. Though impressive, the flight time was nowhere near rivaling transatlantic crossings made by Concorde when the supersonic aircraft was in service. The fastest Concorde flight from New York to London happened on February 7th in 1996 when it crossed the pond in just shy of 2 hours and 53 minutes. I couldn't imagine that, according to BA of British Airways.
Amazing.
No wonder it has the nickname Speedbird. The Norwegian captain, Harald Van Dam, pitcher below, said, "We were actually in the air for just over 5 hours if it had not been for forecast turbulence at lower altitude, or we could have flown even faster." This refers to the Dreamliner, back to the Dreamliner again. Now, Captain Harald Van Dam is in command of the record-breaking 787 Dreamliner flight from New York to London. As Norwegian, he had said, "The 787 Dreamliner is a pleasure to fly, and it's a great feeling to know that we have set a new record in this wonderful aircraft." Now, the airline uses the same aircraft on its two daily flights today between London and New York. The day before, Gatwick-based Captain Pascal Neilwood recorded his fastest ever transatlantic flight, New York to London, in 5 hours and 20 minutes. Neilwood said, "The passengers and crew were pleasantly surprised that we were already landing in London. It was a very smooth flight with almost no turbulence, and as a result of the jet stream, we arrived 25 minutes, nearly a half an hour ahead of schedule." Now, Captain Pascal Neilwood came close to breaking the record the day before. Dorothy?
It takes more than that to saying you did it to take home an official record. You need official observers who independently observe, record, and report on your flight to the NAA. In the United States, air traffic controllers are most commonly used as observers, and it's the pilot's responsibility to find observers. A sanction is part of the record-setting process and a required part. Getting a sanction can take up to 21 days, and sanction fees, which are non-refundable, are based on the takeoff weight of the plane. The more your plane weighs, the larger the sanction fee. Prices are subject to change. For instance, one young man wanted to set a record in an Urkoop. Why, you ask? I don't know. Maybe to have bragging rights down at the Hunt Club. right, George? In the spring
of
2015, the sanction fee was $350 for this 1,800-pound aircraft. That would cover any plane up to 3,858 pounds. For comparison, if it's a plane that sat on the ramp at more than 55,116 pounds, the sanction fee would have been a bit above $1,000. If I'd been flying an ultralight, it would have been a mere $125. This young man flew at the blazing fast speed of 139.66 miles per hour. That doesn't sound very impressive, but you need to know that he was flying a vintage 1947 airplane with an 85-horse engine and a climb prop. This is a type of plane that is rarely shows more than 92 miles per hour on the airspeed indicator. But thanks to Orville's foresight, he could still compete and win until someone else comes along to show a speed of 140 miles per hour and goes through the hoops of having it sanctioned. Now, before we can go into high-speed flight, Neil, don't you think we have a clip we can hear right now? How about it?
I sure do, Dorothy. Now, listen to this. I think you'll enjoy it.
It's called the L.A. Speed Story, and it was just a story about one day it was really cool being an SR-71 pilot. Walter and I were doing a training mission around the United States where you just were building up hours and time, and we take off out of Beale, hit a tanker in Idaho, rip on up to Montana, zip across Denver, hang a right turn in Albuquerque, out over Los Angeles, up to Seattle, back into Sacramento, 2 hours, 21 minutes. And you just do that and you do it backwards, and you hit a tanker or two. It was just to gain crew coordination, build your hours. We're on our last training mission. We're over Tucson. I can see downtown L.A. from Tucson. We're at 89,000 feet. I can see the whole western United States bathed in a warm October fall glow. I can see the chain of Rocky Mountains from Canada to New Mexico. I could just see the most beautiful picture laid at my feet, and the air as smooth as glass. Not a gauge moving in the cockpit. It was perfect. Now I'm thinking, we bad. I feel sorry for Walter because he has to monitor 5 radios in the back seat, so I flipped the switch up just to listen. And L.A. Center is controlling. They control all. When you fly Southwest Air, the guy's controlling everybody. But we're above controlled airspace. So they have us on their scope, but they're not talking to us. Now, there's controllers all over the country. Jacksonville Center, Chicago Center, Seattle Center, you know. It's the same guy. They all talk the same. And it's really cool the way they talk because they make you feel important as a pilot. They don't just say, yeah, okay, here's your thing. They make you feel really cool. So sure enough, this was pre-GPS day. Some Cessna guy has to know his ground speed. L.A. Center, Cessna, November Tango Alpha. You got a ground speed readout for us? Now, Center would like to say, who cares? Get off free. But no, he'll talk to him like he's John Glenn. Cessna, November Alpha, we show you 90 knots, 90 knots on the ground. And they do that sing-song, but that's how they talk. And it makes you feel kind of cool. Right after that, a twin bonanza came up to pimp the guy for speed, I guess, and L.A. Center, Twin Beach, whatever. You got a ground speed readout for us? And Center likes it. God, it's Friday. Why me? God, please, just get off free. But he's going to talk to him like he's Air Force One. Twin Beach, we show you 121, 20 knots on the ground. And right after that, a Navy F-18 out of Lemoore popped up on frequency. And you knew it was a Navy guy because he talked really slick on the radio. Center, Dusty 5-2, speed check. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. Dusty 5-2 has a ground speed indicator and a million-dollar F-18 cockpit. It's right there in the heads-up display. Why is he calling Center to broadcast his speed? I get it. We have just the meanest, baddest, fastest military jet in the valley today. We're taking our little Hornet jet over Mount Whitney and ripping across Death Valley, and we want everyone from Fresno to the coast to know what real speed is. And you can almost hear a little glee in the controller's voice like, we have put an end to this. Dusty 5-2, we show you 620 knots across the ground. And it was that across the ground. See, that little knife like, I hope nobody else has the nerve to get on frequency now. And there wasn't an airliner from Seattle to San Diego that wanted to be next on freak. It's sort of an etiquette thing amongst flyers. and a 12-year-old was reaching for the mic button. And I thought, oh, no, wait, Walter's in charge of the radios. I flew single seat all those years, but I'm in the family model now, and I want it. No, it's the Navy. They must die. They must die now. And I thought, no, but if I do, I'll upset Walter, and I want us to be a good crew. And at that moment, I heard a click of the mic button in the back seat. Ladies and gentlemen, Walter and I became a crew at that moment. His best innocent voice, L.A. Center, Aspen 30, have you got a ground speed radar for us? You could almost hear a collective gasp on Freak, like, oh, the poor fools didn't hear the previous transmissions. Oh, they got crushed like a grape. It's just a pilot thing. But Center had to give you that same voice. Aspen 30, we show you 1,992 knots across the ground. When I knew I was going to like Walter a lot is when he came back and said, Center, we're showing a little closer to 2,000. Ladies and gentlemen, we did not hear another transmission on that frequency all the way to the coast. The king of speed lived, the Navy had been flamed, and a crew had been formed. For just a moment, it was absolutely fun being the fastest guys on the block.
Now we're talking speed. Let's talk about a really fast bird. That's generally what we just heard. Blackbird, SR-71. It's about to lose some of its feathers. Lockheed, son of Blackbird, spy plane might already be here. Lockheed Martin SR-71 Blackbird is one of the most recognizable aircraft design in history. Few other planes have captured the public's attention and imagination in quite the same way as the SR-71, as since it was declassified 1990, nearly 30 years after it entered service. And although now two decades on from the Blackbird's retirement, America's need for supersonic high-altitude surveillance has not diminished. That is why Lockheed's secret Skunk Works team has been developing an SR-72, dubbed Son of Blackbird. Since at least 2007, this next-generation spy plane will reportedly exceed its predecessor in nearly every way possible, rumored to be powered by an air-breathing scramjet engine. The SR-72 will conceivably be capable of topping Mach 6, 4,000 miles per hour, granting the hyperspeed aircraft to the ability to streak across the enemy air defenses before they even know it was there. But drafting a design proposal and building an unmanned airplane capable of breaking the sound barrier six times over are two nearly entirely different animals. It's partly why the SR-72 isn't expected to enter the prototype phase until around 2030, although Lockheed Vice President Jack O'Brien recently hinted that it's already here. Even though the U.S. Air Force has been toying with the technology since 1960, hypersonic aircraft and the scramjets that propel them remain on the breeding edge of aerospace engineering. This is due part to the sheer difficulty in developing. Dr. Bobby Braun, Dean of Engineering and Applied Science at the University of Colorado at Boulder, he had said.
Chuck Braun goes on to say, when it comes to a hypersonic system that's going to carry a significant payload, there are a number of technical challenges. In fact, it's the integration of what are generally three different domains, aero, thermodynamics, structures, and propulsion, that make developing a hypersonic vehicle such a challenge. Hypersonic vehicles have to maintain their shape to get the correct aerodynamic characteristics, Braun explained, which is harder than it sounds when the aircraft's surface is heated to thousands of degrees Fahrenheit due to the friction from the air. Braun also points out that propulsion is an equally daunting challenge, noting that aircraft designed for subsonic flight, for example, a 737, have very different propulsion needs than supersonic fighter jets and hypersonic spy planes. These systems, they're all designed to fly optimally in their domain of interest, Braun said. However, the hypersonic vehicle has to be able to fly at all three speeds. That means that you're either making compromises for the vehicle to fly subsonically and supersonically, which hurts its performance, or you're modifying the propulsion system to transition between supersonic and hypersonic flight, like scramjet. Actually, building and testing such an aviation system poses an entirely different set of challenges. A hypersonic system is going to be relatively costly to build and to operate, Braun said. It's going to be relatively unforgiving to mistakes, because any time you're going that fast, a small discrepancy propagates very quickly. As a UAV, the SR-72's lack of onboard humans ameliorates some of that danger, but does not eliminate the risk of crashing altogether. There would still be some risk associated with it, but in that sense, it's not unlike any other aerospace system, Braun concluded. There's always a risk. Don?
Well, that's why the computer modeling comes in. Computer modeling is incredibly important for this type of work, according to Braun. Quote, a hypersonic vehicle is going to fly at high altitudes at speed, and when it does so, it's going to encounter a different set of conditions that you would if you just took the airspeed at the sea level and accelerated to that same speed. Yeah. Simulating those conditions digitally, sorry folks, currently is the most feasible means of testing hypersonic designs, which far more cost-effective building prototypes and hope that they don't explode during the test. Our computer models have gotten quite sophisticated and capable, Braun continued. Quote, we can design and optimize a complete system in the computer before building it, unquote. While the United States Air Force will be the initial beneficiary of the Skunk Works effort, Braun expects the technology to quickly trickle down to civilian applications. Imagine being able to jet from where you are right now in any place on the planet in 90 minutes. That's the promise hypersonic travel offers. Hypersonic is not just about making a cool-looking vehicle, but putting some payload on it and transporting that payload somewhere quick. Braun said, quote, hypersonic to me is a much larger domain that affects everything from military supply and reconnaissance to rapid delivery of payloads from one point to another, to access to space and to return from space.
Hey guys, let's back up, slow down a little bit to that transatlantic Norwegian flight. I wanted to tell you what a passenger thinks of high speed and records. When Randall Miles, a passenger, woke up from a nap during his flight from L.A. to Paris last week, he opened the interactive map on his seatback screen to see how much longer he'd be in the air. But the number that caught his eye was the jet speed. The Norwegian jet was flying at 770 miles per hour, about 200 miles per hour faster than its standard cruising velocity. He said, I thought, damn, this thing is hauling ass, Miles said. I thought I was either sleepy or I was reading wrong. Well, Miles isn't the only passenger who's gotten the giddy-up treatment in the past couple of weeks. On Thursday, another Norwegian 787 on the same route briefly hit an even faster 779 miles per hour for part of its trip with a tailwind of 224 miles per hour. And on Friday, yet another Norwegian plane used the jet stream to set a new speed record for subsonic transatlantic crossing. We spoke about this before, and that was the Boeing 787 Dreamliner that went from New York Kennedy to Gatwick in 5 hours and 13 minutes. It beat the British Airways 2015 record by 3 minutes and outpaced the standard crossing by a half hour. As we mentioned previously, the Concorde still holds the ultimate record among commercial aircraft at 2 hours and 53 minutes. So, How does a standard Boeing jet carrying a full complement of passengers and luggage fly so fast? Well, that's pretty simple. By taking advantage of a particularly vigorous jet stream, a current of air that's rushing from west to east across the Atlantic. During Norwegian's record-setting flight, that tailwind reached 202 miles per hour and pushed the Boeing, that usually cruises at 570 miles per hour, to 776 miles per hour. If it had not been for the forecasted turbulence at lower altitude, we could have flown even faster, said the captain, Harold Van Dam. I guess he likes to repeat himself because he said that earlier. The same thing. Friday, another Norwegian plane set a new speed record for subsonic transatlantic crossing. Another Boeing 787 Dreamliner went from Kennedy to Gatwick in 5 hours and 13 minutes. I guess he tied the old one. So it goes. Chuck?
Airlines have long made use of the transatlantic jet stream, save time and fuel when flying from the U.S. to Europe. Airlines look at forecast winds and they supply air traffic controllers with their preferred routing, said Ivan Pasternik, a spokesperson for Flight Radar 24, which tracks flight all over the world. Controllers then aggregate those requests and get specific flight paths for the day that will keep everybody safe and happy as possible. The result is known as the North Atlantic Tracks. On their screen, the controllers can see green lines and planes plotted all along them. There's a rainbow in the middle of the screen that marks wind speed with red, significantly the most intense part of the jet stream. This image from 1:17:18 at old 400 UTC time, Universal Time Coordinated, shows the set flight pattern of the plane plotted along them. That rainbow in the middle marks the wind speed, with red significantly the most intense part of the jet stream. Okay, about what is subsonic and supersonic? Well, you might know that the speed of sound at the altitude of 30,000 or 40,000 feet is roughly 670 miles per hour. But Norwegian's plane didn't break the sound barrier. Those near the 800 mile per hour figure represented ground speed, how fast the airplane is moving over land. Their airspeed, which factors out the 200 miles per hour wind boost, was closer to 787, standard Mach 0.85, or 85% of the speed of sound. The older Boeing 747 can cruise at Mach 0.86, but is less efficient than its youngster stablemate. When talking supersonic and breaking sound barriers, it's all about speed or air pushing over the wing, which in this case is more like 570 miles per hour. The hot and heavy jet stream isn't all good. The high winds can increase turbulence, which pilots must work to avoid to protect plane and the passengers are on board. While these fast flights provide a nice publicity bump for Norwegian, airlines typically opt for fuel efficiency over top speed. They use the jet stream to surf a little, cut fuel consumption. Taking your foot off the gas pedal as you go downhill kind of gets you a little more speed with a little less gas. The unexpected fast trip can actually mean being kept in a holding pattern above the destination airport or stuck on the ground waiting for a landing slot or an open gate. Airlines and airports operate on strict schedules, and showing up a half hour early isn't super cool. Forecasts say the strong jet stream lasts maybe for a few more days as it's associated with polar fronts in the northern hemisphere. You get good days, you get bad days in any year, Pasternak said. But as the climate changes intensifies, atmospheric scientists are looking for possible deviations within the usual reliable river of wind that circles the planet. A recent study suggested that the polar jet stream is fluctuating more than normal, but the long-term impact on the Atlantic jet stream, which powers these fast flights, remains to be dedicated and decided. For now, passengers must have to relax and enjoy the especially quick and efficient hop across the pond until it's time to head back. Ken?
Thank you. Yes, and there is such a thing as absolute record. which means, well, the fastest, the highest, or the farthest for anyone. But most records, thanks to good old Orville Wright's forethought, are more limited in what's known as scope. Incidentally, the young man setting a world record speed, sounds impressive, doesn't it, was in Class 1, in a Class 1 Subclass B Group 1, meaning he flew a land plane with a takeoff weight between 1,102 and 2,205 pounds, equipped with an internal combustion engine. Now, the route for this record flight was Albuquerque, New Mexico to Amarillo, Texas, along the historic airmail route. And again, his record will stand forever unless someone else with a C-1B Group 1 plane flies the same route and beats my speed, as he said, by 1% or more. Now, could this happen? Sure. That's the nature of aviation records. Of course, pilots being competitive by nature sometimes view records through a different lens. In the case of this record holder, there was only one other pilot who held the world record in an air group, Robert J. Swanson, back in 1993. So he decided, since he couldn't be first, he wanted to be the fastest. He wanted to beat Samson's record. And he did beat it. Now, his record was 109.15 miles per hour. Actually, a pretty respectable speed in an air group. But the 139.66 miles an hour. But did he really smoke the record? No. Because he flew between different cities, and Swanson did, his record still stands. In fact, the fact that he beat him is fiction, or at least as far as the FAI sporting code is concerned. That doesn't stop the persistent young man from patting his plane on the spinner and calling it the fastest air coupe in the world. Linda?
Well, as a PS note about the air coupe record, he celebrated his record on the 13,502-foot stretch of asphalt. It's called Runway 4 at Amarillo's International Airport. He hadn't even reached the taxiway before the tower radioed, "Congratulations." They told him he had made the flight in about 40 seconds short of 2 hours. He said, "When I flew back home, I found the apron at my home base was decked out, covered with chalk art, congratulations, and my hangar was decked out with blue and white ribbons, and friends gave me a ticker tape parade using canned sprays and string." He goes on to tell us how the process unfolded. "It's not official till it's official," he said. "In my case, I made the flight on April 8, 2015, and my U.S. record was approved by the NAA on May 6. The association then forwarded the documents to the FAI, where my dossier was under review for not quite another 2 months. And then right after the 4th of July," he says, "I received word that the FAI had ratified my record and that I am the current world record holder at 224.76 kilometers per hour because the Swiss convert U.S. records to metric. Then it was time for the champagne," he says. How many records are there? How big a club did he join? A.F. Greenfield, the NAA's director of contest and records, says there are close to 8,500 aviation records in the NAA's database. They date back to 1928, with about 100 new ones recognized in the USA every year. How did he compare with the others? When it comes to the low end, Greenfield said, in the past there were some records set in single digits. Many of those were set over very long courses, where weather or maintenance became an issue, and the clock keeps ticking during that time. And a few years ago, the rules were changed so that all performances now, they must be equal to or greater than the stall speed with the flaps up. And the fastest, the SR-71 Blackbird, flying at 2,193.17 miles per hour, are almost 16 times faster than the air coupe record. Wow. Thanks, Orville. This couldn't have been done in this air coupe without you. The gentleman we cited is William E. DuBois, an aviation writer who holds a commercial pilot certificate with instrument rating and advanced and instrument ground instructor certificates. Of course, he now holds a world record, speed record. He blogs his personal flying adventures at plaintales.net. you spell it planetales.net, to end our show tonight about speed. Well, what could be more appropriate than the sound of this speed? You see if you can identify it.
Identify that speed.
Warp 1.
Warp 1. That is Warp 1, Star Trek. Yes. Very good, guys. Yeah, that was Warp 1.
Chucky Watts and all that stuff.
Great show, guys. You did a wonderful job. Very entertaining, very informative, enlightening. And where else can you hear a show like this on air? On Speed Records, right here on the EAL radio show. I did have the occasion of going about 800 miles per hour, and that was because the jet stream that had dipped extremely south and then took an immediate curve path back north toward Boston, where I was headed, and I was coming up from Mexico City. And from Mexico City over about a little bit north of New Orleans, we hit the jet stream that had turned and headed north. And that jet stream was hauling A. If you remember what George said, it was really, really moving. We figured it was about 250 knots. Most of you are probably aware that jet streams are, they consist of more than just one body of air moving, like a river of air, as it's often called. But there are several rivers of air inside the jet stream, and they're traveling at different speeds. So when you enter a jet stream, it's kind of a little bit turbulent because you've got the friction of another airspeed, or another wind speed, I should say, that is going at a different velocity. So but when we started down, that's when our airspeed started to pick up, when we were cleared to descend. Pushed the nose over, the 757, and we were going maximum speed on the 75 with an additional 250-knot tailwind. So we figured our ground speed at that point was about 800 miles per hour.
Wow.
It's fantastic. It really is once you get in a jet stream. And so that was my experience. Most of the pilots recognize when we used to fly the Boeing 727, we could just count off 8 miles per minute. And we knew that we were going a certain speed, a Mach 8, usually about 8.5, 8.4. But then here we were moving at a faster rate per minute. And to speak of a faster rate, I have some numbers here that I didn't insert in the program tonight. But actually, those guys up at the International Space Station orbiting the Earth, they are orbiting every 92 minutes around the world. So, therefore, their speed is 17,150 miles per hour over the ground, or 4.76 miles per second. Pretty fast. Pretty fast. So, that's hard to compete with as far as subsonic aircraft. And but great story. Great, great show tonight. Any questions or any thoughts about our show tonight, please, from any of our listeners or hosts?
Just think of our fighter planes today. They go past the sound barrier all the time.
Amazing.
I had some sound effects for breaking the speed limit, but it's just a big bang. That's all you hear. Have any of you heard the speed of sound broken? Or actually been an airplane that broke speed of sound?
Yes.
Yes.
Who was that? Jim Hart?
Yes, over the Otis Air Force Base in Massachusetts near Martha's Vineyard. Man, those airplanes came down, and you could hear the boom when they broke the sound barrier.
We had a lot of sound barriers being broken in Pensacola when I lived there. And they would always, in the newspaper, give the schedule of speed and possibly sound barrier interruption. And you could feel it. You could hear it as well.
Braden level is what, 787?
Yeah, 7 something. Yeah, I can't keep those. 762 or something like that.
Bill, weren't they experimenting at one point with what kind of damage could be done on the ground by breaking the sound barrier at certain levels and aiming it at certain levels? Did you remember hearing about that?
Yeah, you know, Eglin Air Force Base is the largest Air Force base in the world for the United States government, and a lot of people don't know that. That's in the panhandle of Florida. And they do a lot of speed breaking the speed barrier there, and it's out in the Gulf of Mexico that most all of this is happening, not over land, because at low altitudes, breaking the speed barrier. The ones I found on the internet were out in the water, close to the shoreline, just to demonstrate the supersonic and then splitting of the air and the beautiful ring around the airplane as it moves through the speed of sound. And it's really pretty. You can watch it on, check your browser and look at some of the YouTube demonstrations of breaking the speed of sound.
That was one of the drawbacks of the Concorde, is as they got closer to land, of course they had to reduce their speed and come below the sound barrier because the people were complaining, obviously.
Yeah.
Remember the meteor that was over Russia when it, it crashed and broke all those windows and stuff in the buildings?
Yeah, tore the buildings apart. Quite a few people got killed. Well, there's a forest up in Siberia where a bigger meteor hit, and all the trees have bent over, and they've been that way since the late 20s when the meteor hit.
Yeah.
It never came back.
But I know, just like Neil says, I've been to a couple of the bases and my travels around, and I've been to Eglin and some of the other places here because we would take our F-4s and run them around and then our 16s later on. And our F-4s, they turned into drones, and they would get them out over the ocean as a drone, which is nothing but a remote control airplane. And they would go so fast that even the pilots couldn't keep up with them because they could make like 12 to 13 G turns because there's nobody in them, whereas the regular pilots couldn't do that.
You know, Chuck,
in the older airplanes.
When you read the part about the son of Blackbird, I think I heard you say that the airplane would not have a pilot in the airplane. Did you hear
it's
that?
It's unmanned, yes, that's correct.
It's unmanned, yeah.
Well, I got everything. But here in the villages, we got our first autonomous taxi cab.
Oh, really?
Pulled up at your house, there's no driver.
Wow. What is it, a golf cart?
No, it's it looks like a Chevrolet, one of those little Chevrolet box cars that they have. You know, Chevy makes this little car. It looks like a little box. I forgot the name of it right now, but they had it in the paper the other day. The first trip that they made. I think they went to Orlando. I'm not too sure. But I know they're running around the village itself. And, of course, that's what's coming. We might be a little older, but we're going to see autonomous cars here in the next 5 years.
They won't last very long down here.
I think some of us are old now.
Yeah.
Chuck, did you go for
Well, we're going to have all that safety equipment in it. Most of the cars we got today, they're coming out in the 2019, 2020s. They stop themselves. They got side views and all that stuff, and you can't wander in and out of your lane, and you can't hit something, and nothing can hit you. So I guess the Jetsons are here.
George, you had a question
for ride on it? Chuck. Did you take a ride on it, Chuck?
No, I didn't. I'm planning on it because my wife and I are going to go to the airport, so we're going to see if we can do that.
Oh, that's wonderful. You got to take.
I have to convince my wife to get in the car.
How do you pay the fare? Do you have an idea?
You do it with a credit card. You just put it in a slot, just like when you go to an ATM machine.
Okay.
Ah, golly.
They got some of the bigger cars now. I think you're going to see somebody like Mercedes or some of those. Some of their big cars are going to come out being autonomous, I would say within the next 5 years or sooner. They have a lot of that stuff. You got to look at it from the standpoint. You guys are all big-time pilots. How much time did you actually fly the airplane? The plane flew itself.
That's not true. Sounds spoken like a true mechanic.
Yeah, there you go. All right.
Hey, I'm the one that puts the black box in there and makes it run, you know.
Yeah, well. We'll give you credit where it's due. You got to do the same for us.
There you go.
I still fly a little airplane, so I know what it is.
My father told me that Eddie Rickenbacker, the first thing he did is he went around and he took all the autopilots out of the aircraft.
Yes, he did.
Because he said he wasn't paying them to sit on their butt. Hey, look, I got to pipe in real quick. Ken's got to have his 2 cents here. I got to go back and tell my only experience with Sonic Boom. Get this, it wasn't really civilian and it wasn't military. So it might make you wonder what it is. And no, it wasn't a meteor. It was in 1997 and I was TDY, the commuter Florida Gulf. It was US Air Express. I was flying out of Orlando temporarily and they put me up in a hotel. And I was sitting there and the door was open because the air wasn't very cold. And it had just rained not too much before that. And I was watching TV. And this person, apparently right next to me, must have slammed their door really hard because it went boom, and the windows went in and out. That's what it felt like and sounded like. And then about 5 or 6 or 7 seconds later, it happened again, but it wasn't as violent, right? So you guys know what it was, right? And all of a sudden, the TV switched, and there's the shuttle, and it was landing.
Oh.
And I literally felt in my gut the sonic boom from the space shuttle. At any rate, that's my story. I thought it was the coolest thing. I didn't even know it was coming in. I'm so dumb. You know, I'm just going through the clicker, looking on the TV, and I was watching Bonanza or something, you know. But I thought that was cool. So that's my only experience with sonic boom. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, well, hey, the last thing I'll say tonight is that one hole in the overcast is better than a dozen published approaches.
I agree with that 100%. Although, you know, with the airplanes that we flew, it was fun making an approaches.
Wasn't it?
It really was. And okay, Dorothy, you take it over and tell us what's happening here.
Well, Neil, first of all, I would like to thank on behalf of Neil and the EAL radio show, our members and hosts, Justin and Linda Fuller, for their generous contribution. We certainly appreciate your donation, and it means a lot to the program to keep us going. Additionally, we had two other sponsors that donated $25 and received Neil's free book, and that was Sharon Destin from Valrico, Florida, and Mary Lee Block from St. Louis, Missouri. And again, we appreciate all donations because that would make us a legacy to carry on. We had five new members this week, John Devereaux from Miami Springs, Jack Morrissey from Lithia, Florida, and Chris, who is a 58-year-old gentleman from Philadelphia and the son of both parents and his uncle, who flew for Eastern from mid-1950s until the early 1970s. His dad was a flight engineer, and his mom was a stewardess, and his uncle was a captain out of Miami, New York, and dates for the Eastern were 1957 to 1963. Then we had two flight attendants joined us. One is Rosa from Silver Spring, Maryland, and she started as a flight attendant and worked from 1969 to 1987 and was based in Boston. She became an in-flight supervisor, and she worked for Kay Dalen. Left Boston in 1978 and transferred to DCA. She worked as a supervisor until 1984 and was promoted to administrative manager, promoted to shuttle manager for DCA in 1968, and then she finally joined Trump Shuttle in 1987, had a very rewarding career. Robin was from Seminole, Florida, and she was an FA at the San Francisco and now retired from the military as she worked for 2 years as a flight attendant with Washington, D.C. Air National Guard. She enjoys traveling when she can, using airline memorabilia. She mentioned she had a short, very short career as an FA, and after training, of course, with the AAL, she had to say goodbye because it was a sad day for all of us. I want to thank all of you for spreading the word as we now have 972 members and moving on to a couple of thousand. So please mention our program and our website to your Eastern friends and friends of Eastern and encourage them to join our membership. We really do appreciate and thank all of you, and we want to continue with the success that we had. We had one letter that Neil asked me to read, and that was from Byron Mayo. And it was, thank you for the ad to the group. I would really like to know how I can help contribute to the memorial that is built, being built. And this is the memorial for the Flight 401, I think it is.
Oh, boy.
Yep. I think it's so important that no one ever forget, and most importantly, have a place to visit. I've been to the Value Jet a couple of times and find it such a peaceful and comforting place to go. I really would like that for the families and loved ones to have, and people as myself, to just remember all the wonderful people who are no longer with us on this beautiful earth, but show our appreciation for the sacrifices that were made and to all the great rescue personnel. Neil, now you went to the Sebring Air Show. What about telling us a little bit about that?
Yes, once a year we go in January to the Sebring Light Aircraft Show. Light aircraft being airplanes that are less than 1,300 pounds. And we went there. I meet with my little brother. Little brother, he's 12 years younger. I still call him little brother. And his friend, and I have Emery that goes with me, helps me drive and get in trouble. But at any rate, we were there, and it was very, very windy. The small airplanes, the light sport aircraft, could not fly the day that we were there at the airport, paid our fare, which is very reasonable to see these airplanes. So we enjoyed the static display and the exhibits that are there at Sebring every year, and it was a lot of fun, even though we didn't see any airplanes flying. Now, one year we were there about 3 years ago, we actually witnessed a stall at low altitude, about 400 feet, and the airplane crashed into the ground right in front of us, killing both the pilot, the owner of the manufacturing company that built the airplane, and a passenger. So, but we've got another air show coming up. We'll be going in April. We'll have a lot of fun. We'll be visiting with the Fullers. Esten and Linda Fuller will be there. So we're looking forward to that, Linda, and seeing you guys. It's a wonderful air show. If you've never been to Sun and Fun in Lakeland, Florida, look it up on your browser, Sun and Fun, Lakeland, Florida, 2018, and you'll find the dates and join us. Lots of folks are there. You'll find a lot of Eastern people there. A lot of people all over the world come to that show. So we'll be there, and hope we'll see some of you out there, listeners and host, please. So that's about all I've got to say. You know, we only have about an hour, hour and a half or whatever on our programs, but it's so fun to talk about Eastern Airlines. It's hard to hang up or play the good night music that we're about to hear in just a minute and let Jim Hart do his thing. But it's so much fun talking about Eastern and bringing up different programs that we put together, perhaps not entirely about Eastern Airlines, but we try to weave into the program little bits of Eastern and how it was involved, too, like we did tonight, the speed records that were set back in the prop days,
Neil,
of Eastern.
Next week,
yes.
Next week we're going to have, on February 5th, that's going to be episode 351, that's going to be the 15 most admired Eastern Airlines employees. So that should be a lot of fun. And then
so,
we follow that with February 12th being aircraft engine power. So that's another good one coming up.
Yeah. So listen in and see if you're a person that you think was a very important contributor to Eastern Airlines. And we've got 15 that we'll be talking about. And we hope you'll be with us again next Monday. So that's about all I've got, but I'm going to put the airplane on the ground, Jim Hart, before you take over, and let's land this 7, whatever it is.
Boy, did he grease that one in. Great landing, Captain Steve.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, be sure, tune in again next Monday, 7 p.m., flight 351. We'll be taxiing to the gate. We have a little bit of adventure coming up, as Dorothy mentioned. That's our show for tonight. And we thank all participating in tonight's broadcast. With this, we take a line from Stories, "We'll Be Gone." Where all the Eastern women are unequaled, all the Eastern men are good-looking, and all the Eastern children and Eastern grandchildren are way above average. Until then, we say, good night, Eastern family.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
We love you.
Love you, Eastern. Good night.